Welcome to Conversations in MedEd, the people behind the research. Hi, Louise, and thanks for joining me. It's great to have you.
Hi, Nikki.
Could you maybe just introduce who you are? So what do you do? Where are you based?
Yeah, of course. So hi, my name's Louise Allen. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Medical Education, which is part of the Melbourne Medical School at the University of Melbourne in Australia. I'm a postdoc there, as I said, so it's largely a research focus role, but I'm also involved in developing and teaching into some of our research subjects in our graduate certificate and graduate diploma of clinical education. I also have a little casual role on the side, so I'm a casual consultant in the regulatory services team for Dietitians Australia, which is, to no surprise by the name, our professional and regulatory body for dietitians in Australia. And there I really do the CPD audit, I assess advanced accrediting practicing dietitian applications and do a few other bits and pieces there.
Very interesting. So you are a dietitian by training, is that correct?
Sure am.
And how did you move from being a sort of practicing dietitian into a postdoctoral researcher in education and continuous professional development?
Yeah, so I completed my undergrad in dietetics and did an honours year, which was a clinical project. So it wasn't really my plan to set out to end up in education. But after graduating, I worked for about 4 years clinically, both in a regional hospital in Australia and in some locum roles in the UK. And while doing that, sort of decided that I didn't think working clinically forever was for me. And I'd already sort of been interested in education, had some really great lecturers in my undergrad. I always liked helping my peers learn, and we'd have little study groups and things like that. And so I was wrapping up my 2 year visa in the UK. I started to think about maybe education might be for me, and doing a PhD at that time makes sense. I was used to sort of not having a whole lot of money because I was spending it traveling while I was living in the UK. So I had a few conversations with one of my mentors who was a lecturer of mine. I didn't have a great experience in honours with my supervisors, and so I was quite particular about making sure that I chose the right people and a project also that I was interested in. I had a few conversations back and forth on different topics and different things there, and eventually landed on a PhD looking at continuing professional development and the impacts of that. I did that at Monash University started in 2017, which seems like a long time ago now. I was fortunate enough to do that full time, so that was quite a nice luxury and gave me a lot of time to do the thinking that I think I needed, because as I said, I went from dietetics, very positivist, doing a clinical honours project to, yeah, I'll do a PhD in education and not knowing a whole lot about theory and philosophy and all of those things that take quite a while to get your head around them. And so I finished my PhD in 2020, was meant to go to the US to do a Fulbright then, but obviously COVID got in the way. So worked for Dietitians Australia in a project role and then as the credentialing manager for a little while before getting a job at Monash as a lecturer in a Centre for Professional Development, so I was more education focused around getting micro credentials up and running, and eventually got to do my Fulbright in 2022-2023, and then on the way back, when I was figuring out what I'd do while I was in the US, the centre that I worked for at Monash closed, so I was still had a role but I didn't know what I was going to be going back to, and sort of fortuitously in some conversations that I was having, this role at the University of Melbourne popped up, and so it sort of was a nice pathway for me to come home, and instead of going to a job I didn't know what it's going to be, I started this new role that I'm been in now for a year and a half.
Wow, that's very, very cool. I mean, you said so many great things in terms of just the practicalities of finding a research project and topic that you love and having a good supervisor. That relationship, you know, it's going to endure for 3 years, maybe longer, probably longer. And also just being aware that if you're a full-time student, you'll have no money.
I was very aware of that.
Yeah, if you want to be poor, just keep studying or go into academia.
Well, like I said, I literally was doing locum jobs and I would earn money and then I would say, I'm going to go travel somewhere nice. So I was like, well, it's kind of like having a scholarship. You get paid a chunk and you just got to live off that amount of money. So
yep,
it was a good time to do it.
So why CPD in particular? Did it just sort of resonate with your learning journey, or did you see sort of a gap or a need, or why do you think is a strategic area to focus on?
Yeah, I think it was both an area of interest, but I think it was also a pragmatic decision. Obviously, like I said, the supervisors were a very important component of that. And so I had probably two or three projects I was sort of deciding between, and that would have had different supervisors. But obviously, as a dietitian, I was required to do professional development. I'm still required to do professional development. And as I'm sure many people have experienced, you go to some and you're like, oh my God, this is great, I've learned so much. And you go to others, and in my case, quite a lot, and you're like, well, didn't really get a whole lot out of that. And I guess I didn't really know sort of the theory of education and those sorts of things in the background at that time. But to me, the ones that were I got more out of were there was problem solving, you were talking to people, there was that interaction. And so with my own experience of that, I thought, yeah, like, I mean, this is a requirement for nearly all professions in most countries in terms of health professions and needing to do a certain number of CPD hours. And knowing that a lot of the research really just looked at knowledge, attitudes and skills when it comes to looking at the impacts. And so looking beyond that to sort of what are some of those bigger picture outcomes around the people that you meet and the networks you go on to form, around the people that you go on then to influence, whether that be your students, your peers, procedures and policies at your organisations, those sorts of things. And so, yeah, that sort of had a combination of something I was interested in and a team that I thought was going to be really great and really supportive, especially in Australia. We have an apprenticeship model for our PhD, so we don't have a doctoral program per se. You don't have coursework. So your experience of your PhD is really reliant on the support that you get from your supervisors. So that was the biggest thing for me, probably more so than the topic, was making sure that team was going to be a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it's same in South Africa. While it's the PhD I did, it was all pretty much self-study, self-regulated learning with guidance from your supervisor. There wasn't any official coursework to read, just like, oh, here's a paper. And you mentioned that very steep learning curve coming from a very sort of positivist scientist background into, you know, qualitative research, feeling, social sciences, theory. What's a theoretical framework? What's constructivism? I think many of our listeners will be able to resonate with that. But just to maybe drop a couple hints that Louise has published on looking at evaluation and how perhaps why Kirkpatrick's model, while very popular and a good starting point, might not sort of get to the underlying issues of how and why certain interventions work, which I think is very important. And then she's mentioned things like maybe the social theory of learning. So she has a paper on that. So maybe do you want to just share a little bit about those, sort of the big ideas or what takeaways researchers should get from those papers?
Yeah, sure. So the paper you mentioned about Kirkpatrick and evaluation really came out of my PhD. It wasn't part of my PhD. It was sort of a piece after, while I was mulling around waiting for things to happen with COVID and my degree getting conferred and all those fun things you do when you submit your PhD. So I was obviously looking at professional development, and a lot of the papers I was looking at, particularly in a scoping review that I did, were using Kirkpatrick in their evaluation, and they were calling it a theory and a framework. And I was looking at it being like, well, really, it's just a classification of outcomes. Like, it's not telling you how to do this. It's not telling you to investigate why these things are going on. And so I was trying to wrap my head around, well, why are we using this so much? And I mean, it's not to say that I think it's bad. I think it's just recognizing what it is and how it can be useful. And so the point of that paper is really to say, if we're doing evaluation in education, which is complex and very context dependent, just measuring the outcomes isn't really going to tell us the whole story, because it doesn't give us those insights into the how and the why, as you mentioned. And so, having done that, I was like, all right, let's do a deep dive on what are we doing in health professions education in terms of evaluation. And so did a review and looked at, well, I can't even remember how many papers now, but really showing that outcomes evaluation models such as the Kirkpatrick are used far more frequently than a raft of theory-driven and other educational evaluation approaches that are much more grounded in theory and in actually helping us to understand what's going on. And so, big plug that if you do want to use Kirkpatrick, and that's more than fine, just to be thinking about it as what it is, and perhaps you incorporate it as part of another broader evaluation approach. If you're wanting to do a more publishable, researchy type evaluation piece, I do understand that there's going to be evaluations that we need to do sort of quick to convince our boss that we should keep doing something this way, or we should change something this way, and that's a different story. The other piece was around, you mentioned around social learning. And so that was sort of the middle piece of my PhD around looking at some of those broader outcomes. And so the courses that we chose to look at were the Harvard Macy courses, and we were running sort of sister courses at Monash at the time. And so I think they actually are very intentionally geared towards that social connection and bringing people together and having those interactions. But still, to me, it was very surprising just the number of impacts that people were describing and the influence of really that those people were having and the importance of that ability to learn together. And I think in this day and age where lots of our things are now online, I think that's really important to remember and to think about how can we foster those connections and conversations in times when we're not necessarily in the same room as people.
Yeah. That's really important. And then maybe just to plug one more paper on CPD. You looked like a narrative study. Do you maybe want to just share some of the highlights from that? Because I'm really interested. I was really enjoyed reading through it.
Yeah, sure. So that was the work I did for my Fulbright postdoctoral scholarship. Big shout out to Lara Varpio and Dorian Barmer. They were my advisors for that work. So that was it was a narrative study looking at physician learning journeys post-training. And really trying to just get at the idea of how do they conceptualize themselves as learners and how does their learning change as their careers progress. Ideally, that would have been some longitudinal work, but it was sort of a one point in time reflecting, looking back. And really just looking at how we support learners and learning a lot in training and in medical school and in health professions, other health professions as well. But once people reach professional practice, it's sort of a go forth, you're on your own. And so that sort of lack of structured learning in combination with high workloads, steep learning curve of you're actually a health professional now and needing to do all that practice, really around looking at, we sort of phrase it as going from a train on a track to treading water, as that was one of the words from our participants. So losing that structure, that concept that learning takes a back seat because you have all of these other responsibilities that just come before that. And even though all of the people we spoke to very much saw themselves as learners and saw learning as important, just there's only so many hours in a day and you've sort of got to prioritize what you're doing. And then really just around how you go about learning then and identifying what's going to work for you. And a lot of, given the lack of structure, a lot of learning in the moment and doing what's there and not necessarily that strategic planning for addressing perhaps those gaps or areas that you might need to work on. So I guess some of the implications for that, we had some recommendations around how we might address that, both individuals and what they can do, but also more from a regulatory perspective, and that perhaps the structures that we've put in place for professional development and accreditation that way might not necessarily be really the way that's going to work in terms of learning for health professionals.
Yeah, not the most effective. And you also made the point about not just sort of the formal learning systems, but all the informal learning that takes place continuously on the job. Yeah,
and especially in the US, that's where this work was situated. A lot of that isn't counted. You can't actually count that informal learning, and mentoring specifically is called out as not counting for AMA credit, Category 1 credits, which is kind of like the gold standard in the US. And so despite all the research that we know about how useful mentoring is for learning, both for the mentee and the mentor, that specifically isn't included along with a bunch of other informal learning opportunities. So a bit of a disconnect there, I think, in terms of I mean, trying to be able to just easily measure and monitor learning versus some of the stuff that we know that actually is really good for learning that doesn't count.
Yeah, especially when time is limited and to just count those little interactions that are really powerful. And I do also like it that in the discussion section you mentioned the limitations of self-assessment. And, you know, we don't know what mm-hmm. we don't know and how you need that outsider who does know to tell you. But despite that, I'm going to ask you to sort of self-assess and just think about on sort of your research, but also your journey into the field and thinking about, you know, health professionals who should be continuing their own learning and to become a lifelong learner. What do you see as helpful in your own journey, and what advice would you give to people who, you know, they might want to move into the field of education, but they might just want to be sort of better practitioners and better learners? And I think that's the irony when it comes to the service versus educational training debate. You're a better service provider when you're continually learning and upskilling, and so often they sort of sacrifice the long-term gain for the short-term, I need to treat the patient today, instead of seeing mm-hmm. like investing in their own learning actually benefits the patient in the long run. But that's sort of besides the point. what sort of advice or lessons have you learned or reflections you think are valuable that our listeners might resonate with?
Yeah, sure. So I might do two parts. I might do one from my hat of the experience of transitioning from a clinical practitioner to a researcher in education, and I can give some practical advice perhaps that might be useful to people as well. Sure. So I guess from my experience in terms of moving from a clinician into a health professions education and to be a researcher, I think the biggest shift, as we've spoken about, was around that world view. Mm,
yeah.
And so a lot of that learning I did in my PhD was really wrapping my head around other paradigms and worldviews and that are more qualitatively aligned, which I think probably always spoke to me, but I just didn't have the language and didn't really know those ways of thinking. And so figuring out what epistemology and ontology are and how they influence your research. And so I guess not to be put off by those big words and those big terms and things like that, but to be, it's okay to be uncomfortable with those things, and just recognizing that, I mean, the field we work in is complex and context dependent, and so those ways of thinking, I think, are, at least to me, what's going to answer the questions that we have. And with that in mind, I would say that qualitative research is more than just doing some interviews and analysing and some themes emerge. So if you are thinking about going down the qualitative route, spend some time thinking about those bigger things and thinking about, is this phenomena or thing or concept that I'm interested in likely going to be of interest to other people? And if so, what's going to be of interest to other people, and how should I best go about looking at this that is going to help others? Because I think often we're in our little bubble and we think, I've got this research problem or this practice problem in front of me, and so I'm going to do this bit of work because it's going to help me do that, which is fine. But if you're wanting to, again, pitch it from a research perspective, thinking about how is this going to be of use to other people and what sort of things do I need to consider? From that perspective, there are two papers I really would shout out, and I pretty much direct to anyone and everyone I can. Again, one is new. It was published this year. It's by Renee Stellmeyer, Megan Brown and Bridget O'Brien. It's in Clinical Teacher, and it's called How to Discuss the Transferability of Qualitative Research in Health Professions Education. That I think everyone who is even thinking about doing or reading qualitative research should read. Similarly, a slightly older one, 2017, Shedding the Cobra Effect by Lara Varpion and colleagues in MedEd. It's got a longer title, but literally if you type Shedding the Cobra Effect and Lara Varpion, you'll get it in Google. But I think two sort of key papers, especially if you're sort of new to the field, sort of grappling with those things of generalizability in quantitative research versus transferability in qualitative research, of things like saturation or sufficient information power, sort of some of those dynamics and things that sort of, until you start thinking about your perspective and how you actually approach the world, you don't necessarily think of, which is definitely new when you come to qualitative research.
No, that's fantastic advice and really great resources. I can wholeheartedly recommend them too. I love them. I share them with my students. And again, I think for me, very similar journey. And again, being caught up on my own blind spots. You know, you'll say I'm doing a qualitative study and then talk about data saturation. And there's a sort of inconsistent, you know, you're not being coherent in your worldview or the paradigm that you're operating within. And I think that is a huge conceptual shift for most people, you know, for you and for me. So listeners, don't be alarmed. It's completely normal. It's a steep learning curve, but it's once you can see, it really is like you're operating in a brand new universe. Very exciting.
Oh, 100%. I think it comes back to, you said it before, like you don't know what you don't know, right? And so especially I think earlier on, a lot of the qualitative research did have things like mentioning data saturation and thematic emergence, and that was just how things were written. But I guess as we as a field in health professions education have actually gotten better at sort of the coherence and alignment of our work and articulating the philosophies that underpin what we're doing has really helped with that shift. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure if you go back and look at publications by a bunch of people in HPE that are qualitative researchers now, they will have mentioned thematic emergence at some point back in the line. So it's a process of learning for all of us. And I'm sure as we, the next 5-10 years, there'll be things that we start writing about that we weren't doing previously.
Great. Any last sort of comments or reflections or advice, either based on your own journey or your research, any take-home messages?
I guess this probably applies to both to those researchers and to those in practice. To me, and it probably is no surprise from what came out of my work around social learning and the importance of that, is seek out mentors. Doesn't have to be formal people that you can go to, that you can have these conversations with. It might be peers, it might be people at the same stage as you, it might be people super duper far above you, it might be people younger than you. Because I think that's one of the best ways that we learn is having those conversations. And I think if you're new to research or if you're in a clinical area, they're a great way to learn and a great resource to have, and to your point before, can help you sort of with some of that self-diagnosis in terms of self-assessment and what you should focus on and improve on. So always a big plug for guided self-assessment rather than individual self-assessment.
Thanks, Louise. We really appreciated your time. I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, 2-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics, theory, and evidence from the field, and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage. Links can be found in the show notes.